Hey folks, this is the Contextual Insurgent Podcast, and I'm your host, Aaron Smith. I'm an activist, an analyst, a writer, and a sensemaker. I'm a Republican, a former SFGOP Central Committee Delegate, where I was the Deputy Vice Chair of Communications. As California GOP-endorsed State Senate candidate, where I managed to win 11% of the vote in San Francisco, which, trust me, is better than average. I've also been involved with the firearms community and Second Amendment rights. I was on the cover of Time magazine in November of 2018 for their Guns in America issue. But I'm probably best known for my free speech activism and facing off with hard lefties like Antifa in California and the Pacific Northwest since 2017. The general topic of this podcast series will be politics in the current culture war, as seen from my unique, rather hands-on experience and knowledge, but also intend to include a practical element focused on giving you the conceptual tools to build towards true grassroots, nonviolent political change. You may have noticed lefties usually seem to get what they want regardless of how elections go, and I want to help you change that. You can also sign up for my Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I have a weekly newsletter that looks back at some of the highlighted stories of the week and gives you some feedback and analysis of what's happening. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/EESmith4. That's the number 4. I also have a Cash App at $EESmith4. Again, that's the number 4. For the cost of a mocha frappuccino once a month, you can support my work, which is ultimately about helping you. Howdy, everyone. Welcome back to my podcast. It's January 11th, 2021. And let me start off by saying, wow, that escalated quickly. I'm fairly sure you're aware of what I'm talking about. Last week, the Capitol was overrun by a bunch of people that were at the Trump rally, the Stop the Steal Trump rally, and it's led to a little bit of drama, you might say. Half the internet seems like it's deplatformed and Trump's banned from Twitter, which is something I think most of us knew was coming eventually. But anyway, so let's go over what all this means. I've got Tech Bro Tito here with me today, joining for the conversation. He is starting up his podcast and a blog at USSA.today. Tech Bro, do you want to introduce yourself or say anything really quick?
What is old is new again, comrades. And we reemerge the new world where America is less going concern as a republic and more concern as united republics, as we say.
Yeah, I kind of feel I feel like we're in a very partisan mood in this country right now. So yeah, let's talk about what happened. It was, the Stop the Steal rally happened the same day the election certification was due to be certified. There was like several different states sent, well, not the states, but some of the legislatures sent separate state slates of electors. There were supposed to be at least like, what is it? I think at least 3, and they were talking like maybe 10 states they were going to have objections for, and that's like 2 hours apiece. They were talking about running it through the night. Anyway, Trump spoke and sent the crowd to go protest next to the Capitol. Now, what I understand is they had a permit for the south side of the Capitol, but you know, everyone was kind of wound up when they were walking towards the Capitol and the fence got knocked down. Long story short, people flooded the Capitol. 5 people are dead now. 4 people, Trump rally folks, and 1 police officer. A lot of things probably went wrong with that. I think they had, like, obviously it went wrong, but I think the thing really stands out to me, and this is something that we see a lot with the lefties, is, you know, when they actually have like a march or a rally, they have their marshals and their people that they're very organized about how do you get like a large crowd of people from one place to another safely without, you know, all kinds of drama, like people running off on their own and smashing things up. I mean, granted, they do have stuff smashed up a lot of times at a lot of riots and protests, but it was really interesting. The video from that's pretty wild. It's like they knocked the police line down, and of course no one expected it because a lot of right wingers have been very pro police. But I think lately we've seen an issue with like we saw this in Olympia, and I wrote about this in my Substack a couple weeks ago. There was kind of a brawl between the cops. There's actually been a couple brawls between the cops and a lot of the Patriots, Trump, MAGA people. And I was worried about that once that line got crossed, if they would start turning on the cops a lot and it would stop listening to them. But yeah, it was It's pretty insane. And after that happened, yeah, the internet said, like, Parler's been deplatformed. Like, there's a gun website has been lost. Their GoDaddy hosting, ARFCOM's, like, the largest, AR15.com's the largest gun website on the internet. They lost their hosting. And they didn't even have anything to do with it. And it was just random guns, the biggest gun site, but they didn't have any official connection. Parler's down. Trump's banned from Twitter. It seems like half of Twitter's banned now. Parler's been, like, absolutely deplatformed down the full stack of everything, like hosting and registrar. It's pretty crazy.
Gab has problems. DLive is having problems throwing people off.
Yeah.
It reminds one of purges from 1930s.
Yeah, it does. It's pretty crazy. I think the thing, people joke, you know, there's that thing. It's actually funny. I'm the one who originally said this, and like Larry Correa ran with it. The quote where, you know, lefties have a spectrum and righties have a knob as far as violence goes. And holy shit, did the Capitol really show that? Like, when you storm the Capitol and you send the government running, the vice president and senators and how, that's a pretty solid escalation, you know, as far as, do you have anything? What do you think?
Well, question is what was supposed to be done. We have plenty of video showing cops allowing protesters in and then protesters fighting said cops. The question is the unified narrative, and the narrative control is all. And this is why USSA is the coming future, not multiple perspectives, but one united perspective, one of the people, one speaking for the justice. This is the one coming, come inauguration of the incoming comrades Biden and Harris.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that really stands out, like this wild reaction, in a real sense, what happened, I wish no one had gotten, I mean, I wish no one had gotten killed, period, but I feel like it would have probably been more of a narrative victory if that hadn't happened, because that always is a serious blow to anything. I feel like when you have a body count, and some of that, a lot of what happened with that, again, you know, there's righties are not good at organization and things kind of spin out of control, and I feel like that happened a lot. That happened for sure, because you cannot get those people spun up and just head them towards the Capitol without expecting, because the tensions have been really high in the country. You know, the whole electoral fraud thing has been incredibly contentious. Like, most Republicans believe that there was significant fraud. I mean, there's always some fraud in an election. I'm not going to make a comment one way or the other. I mean, there's lots of unforced errors, and there's always some fraud. And I think the thing is that, for me, it's less about whether or not if you can prove fraud. It's like, no one can really, you can't prove it either way, and there's not enough trust on either side where you can accept the results. Like, I think everyone knew going into this election that no one was going to trust the results. I talked about this in my Shutdown DC episode last season. They were planning to essentially destroy Washington, D.C. if Trump had a resounding victory. The left was, they were planning to shut down cities across the country. They were planning to shut down infrastructure. I did a whole episode where I explored what they were doing. I went in their chats, got a whole bunch of information on them. The Transition Integrity Project, which John Podesta was actually involved with that. A bunch of other, like Barbara Brooks was, she was one of the organizers. Her mother is one of the founders of Democratic Socialists of America. But go back and check that episode out, Shutdown DC, and check out the episode about the Democratic Socialists of America. They were planning to threaten secession. Like, that was part of their plan. Like, it was like pretty intense. Like, if Trump had a resounding victory with no doubt about it, they were going to threaten secession. They were going to have the governors send alternate slates of electors. Like, they had laid out the plan for what they wanted to do. And, like, I think essentially no one expected going into this election that it was going to be the results were going to be accepted either way. Either way, there's not enough social capital, I think, in America right now where people can really do that. And for me, I think the real the capital, the assault on the capital, the occupation of the capital. I've heard some people call it Occupy Rotunda, and I think that's probably a pretty good definition or a good label for it. The thing that really stands out to me for this is the establishment is even more terrified of that than they were of Trump's election in 2016. For, you know, I was living in San Francisco at the time, and it seemed like they never expected Trump to win, and they convinced themselves that there was no possible way. And a lot of these people, the blue state people, the so-called the elite class people, you know, when your life is based around like manipulating abstractions, you can convince yourself of anything. And they convinced themselves with their models and their data that this outcome was never going to happen. And it happened. And that really shook them to their core. And they spent the last 4 years trying to sweep that back under the covers and like make it go away. And then they think they've done it again. You know, they actually, it was interesting because the polls were so off. I mean, it was like 30 points off for like the white college. Like I talked about this in one of my Substacks. I think it was like mid-November. I can't remember the exact date. But some of the polls were 30 points off, depending on certain demographics. But I think the thing about the Capitol that really shook them was this is in a real way what happened in the Capitol was what they imagine flyover country people to be. Like imagine you're some hoity-toity, upscale, blue, you know, coastal Acela corridor person. And this half-naked man in animal pelts storms the Capitol and sends senators and the vice president running and, like, jumps up on the dais and, like, seizes control, like, sacks your Capitol. Like, that is, like, I think that really hit the visceral core of who they see in themselves. And it really shook them in a way that even Trump's election 4 years ago never could.
Well, it's funny contrast, actually, to look at the looting of Rome by the Visigoths. And so you literally have pagan, Germanic-looking people raiding capital of great nation that let them in and is scared of them. So, you know, for the historical speaking people, you have great fears of you know, recapturing the sack of Rome from actual Vandals, giving us the name today. But I think this also exposes another things that people on the right don't get, and that is, it doesn't matter what class you come from if you are on the left, as long as you are properly educated in class conflict, you are a comrade in arms. It doesn't matter your color. It doesn't matter where you come from. It matters that you know class consciousness, and everyone is a comrade if you know class consciousness. If you don't engage in class consciousness, by definition, you are a bourgeois enemy that must be destroyed. This is something that I don't think is understood well enough on the right.
It's a good point. It's funny. The founders had such a fetish for Rome, and so much of American history and iconography, especially in the beginning, is based on Rome. And like now to see that, you know, this is a little too on the nose. It's like, you know, our Senate that's modeled on Rome is like conquered by a man in a bear pelt, and senators are running and squealing, and you know, he actually ran up there and was like, "Where's Mike Pence? You know, show yourself." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's a little too on the nose for Roman LARPing." But yeah, I think that is the deal with them is it really impact their vision of themselves. The class consciousness, like you're saying, it's like there's the social class, you know, economic class, but then there's also the kind of the cultural Marxist identitarian version of it.
Right, and that is what I come to talk about today. It's important to understand, it doesn't matter how poor you are, how rich you are, if you are ally of the struggle, ally of the revolution, it doesn't matter if, as long as you are down with the cause, if you are comrade. And this is very important to understand, because the left will brook no conflict with class consciousness and with Marxist understanding. As long as this is your god, there is no problem, everyone gets along, because the solidarity is fully through this class consciousness and classic Marxist-Leninist teaching. The problem is that if you don't adhere to this, that is a competition. And so this sounds this sounds esoteric, but it's not. Very simply, the difference between a conspiracy theory and between proper thinking is a conspiracy theory allows you to criticize those in power without reverting to Marxist ideology that has been shown time and again to be co-opted by capitalist interests. I'll state that again. A conspiracy theory is that which allows you to criticize the ruling class in a systematic way that does not involve Marxist critique, which is shown time and again it can be bought off and the revolution could be subsumed.
I think the thing that really hits me with this is we're living in part of living in a post-industrial information society is that when your entire economy is based around manipulating abstractions, status becomes based on manipulating abstractions as well, which is where you get things like critical race theory and all this, you know, Ibram X. Kendi, all of his work, this so-called anti-racist work, which is, it's complete gibberish, but your status and access to society is based in large part, originally started in colleges, but now it's spreading to the rest of the country. Your status is based on how well you can manipulate these abstractions and recite them back in particular settings. You know, they're not meant to be, it's one of those things, like when the story about the greengrocer, you know, he puts Vaclav Havel's story where, you know, the greengrocer puts the sign in the window and it doesn't matter what the sign says, it's how he signals his obedience and submission to the system. He doesn't actually have to believe it, he just has to pantomime believing it, because pantomiming that belief will, over time, you know, if you continually act like you believe something, it's very hard to not believe it over time. It's going to brainwash you, you know. Actually, that actually happens too. Like, even if you don't believe it, acting like you do will reinforce it in other people as well.
Right. I mean, you have Theodore Dalrymple quote about the point of totalitarianism is to make you tell lies you know are lies, because it humiliates you and that destroys your own ability of conscience to act. This is an important thing, part of the socialization of the person and the de-individualization. I'm not going to go too deep into Marxist thought and Marxist praxeology, because it is a great big web meant to confuse and to have people that are not dedicated party members be identified and to be thrown out, which is the entire point of it. The point of it is everything is about parties, about class conflict. You mentioned Ibram X. Kendi. The point is these all are based off of Marxist conceptions, whether you go with critical theory with Horkheimer and Marcuse, whether you go back all the way to the Italian with the March through the Institutions. The point is, it is all Marxism all the way down. And the point about Marxism itself, of course, comes from French Revolution. And the point is, there is no private person, there is no private conscience. There only is engaging in the conflict completely, or being a class enemy.
Yeah, I think, you know, and just so the audience, Ibram X. Kendi is the guy, he wrote that book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, I think it was called. He's the current, him and Beverly D'Angelo, that's the woman who wrote the White Fragility book. Those are like the two leading people for so-called anti-racist movement. By the way, anti-racism comes from Angela Davis. Angela Davis, I wrote about her from Mindy's website, because she, when I was talking about Chesa Boudin, the San Francisco district attorney, she's essentially an openly communist, formerly top 10 most wanted. She helped kill a federal judge and helped some black nationalists escape from Marin County back in the 70s, I believe it was.
Correct.
Yeah, there was an estimate at one point that she was a member of the Communist Party and she ran for president of the United States, and something like 5% of the money the KGB spent in the United States that year was spent supporting her campaign. It was pretty crazy. And she's a so-called abolitionist. She's someone who wants to abolish prison. She says she wants to abolish prison, but at the same time, she was confronted, Isaac Asimov confronted her because she was not supporting dissidents in Eastern Europe who were imprisoned for their beliefs. And she's like, they're traitors to the revolution and let them rot in prison. So much for being an abolitionist. Anyway, Ibram X. Kendi, that's who that is. And the funny thing about Ibram X. Kendi is his entire career undermines his claims. Like he, and this guy's pretty funny. If you don't believe me, look this up. He has openly admitted his GPA was under 3.0. He had like a 1,000 SAT score. And he had this crazy belief. And this is the funniest thing when you explore these people, a lot of these hard left folks, especially these so-called thought leaders, they have insanely wacky personal beliefs. Like Ibram X. Kendi, he says he no longer believes this, but he actually admitted that for a while he believed that white people were space aliens. He has a fairly humorous encounter that I've read about where he, you know, was reading a bunch of stuff and a bunch of crazy black nationalist claims about the origins of white people, and he completely convinced white people were space aliens. And anyway, that's the type of person he is. Like, not there's anything wrong being like, say, an assistant manager of an AutoZone, but like that's should have been more of his career track. Instead, he's an academic and he's got a tenure, and Jack Dorsey from Twitter gave him like $10 million. So it's pretty crazy. There was $11 billion this past summer that was spent on this anti-racist BLM stuff. But I think the thing too, again, you know, this is all about manipulating abstractions. So much of this with the post-information economy. I think these folks, what happened at the Capitol, like we're seeing this insane backlash. We're seeing so many people have been deplatformed. The President of the United States has been banned from essentially almost every social media platform. Tons of other people have been banned. Like there's been hundreds of thousands of people purged, a bunch of other websites knocked offline. Parler is completely shut off the internet. Trump has been like, they're in the process of cutting him off from banking. So it's been this wild backlash. And I think a big part of that was, you know, they thought that they had beat Trump. And then Trump, you know, it's like in the horror, because I heard one of them mention that, you know, online, it's like the horror movies where they're still like, you defeat the monster, but there's 10 minutes left in the film. And you're like, what's going to happen next? So that happened, and I feel like it really wounded them, like in a psychological, like a lot of these crazy lefties, they were just really wounded, and that's why they're reacting that way. What do you think?
Well, to quote former President Obama, the arc of history is long but bends towards justice. There's a teleology here that the end of the world is understood. It is understood completely in terms that they will win in the end. They have reconstructed themselves a religious understanding of the world. And it is an inversion, you can think, of Christian idea, which is that history of the world is long but depends towards Christ, as opposed to this is it history of the world is long but depends the arc of justice is long but it bends towards justice. And so the idea is they win in the end, they know the ending, and so anything that tracks against that threatens them because they don't truly have faith in the same way.
Yeah, it's like this is very much a post, you know, wokeness is very much a post-Christian mind virus, a belief system. I remember when I was in Berkeley, there was that rally in Berkeley like 2 weeks after Charlottesville it was in 2017, and they went till the left in the Bay went totally crazy, and this was some fairly normal Trump people holding a rally, but something like 20,000 people came out to oppose us. And I remember seeing this girl who had something that she almost started speaking in tongues. She was a counter protester and had like this religious ecstasy experience. It looked like something like mixed, like some Pentecostal talking in tongues and like having a seizure. And it was watching the crowd when that went on, it was so much like, I was like, this is something like a post, this is a whatever, if we're living in a secular world, this is something the closest thing to a new religion that's filling that hole. And it's spread around the country. It's pretty crazy. And like you said, it's true. It's like these people are very, it's heavily Puritan in the sense, like there's that Calvinism, like everything is preordained. We are the elect, you know, the end of the world, the eschaton is ahead of us and we know what it's going to be. So when these things happen that aren't supposed to happen, it shakes them to their core in a way that it's really hard to express to a normal person that's not either, you know, if you've never seen this type of religious ecstasy. And yeah, I actually, and just to sidetrack on that, I think about religion, like my theory with it is like, we keep calling wokeness a religion, and I think that's sort of true. I think what it is religion itself is something that our brain works a certain way, and religion is kind of the system that evolved over millennia that kind of dampens, like a shock absorber on a car, like these crazy impulses we have. So when we came to the secular world and we wiped religion away, and I spent 20 years as an atheist, and I'm no longer an atheist in large part due to the experiences I've had. But we've wiped that away, and something that has filled its place that hasn't had the adequate time to evolve and become non-destructive, because they're on something like almost like a religious crusade. It's like it's almost like a witch hunt right now, like with everything that's going on the internet, all the crazy talk about. It's just it's insane. The people that are talking about, they want to put everyone on a no-fly. Look, there's 75 million people in the country that voted for Trump. Maybe there's, you know, not all of them. Maybe some, they're talking more of the hardcore Trumper people. But still, you know, they're wanting to have open struggle sessions and lists of everyone. And, you know, this purge of society. And it's pretty crazy. Have anything you want to say more about that?
I think it's important to understand in ways. To quote a properly taught first premier of China, Zhao Enlai, when asked about the French Revolution, he said, about the impact, he responded, "It's too soon to say what the final impact of the French Revolution is." To understand communism, to understand this, it's a melding of religion with a way of life. It's harder to understand. Puritanism is perhaps best way for Americans to understand, because it is a unification of religion with way of life. It's more monastic in a way, and the need to continue it and to do good works. It is Calvinist in the way that by proof of your success on earth, you earn your place in heaven, because it is a purely material world that they're working in. And so the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And that is, did you do work? Did you not? Did you bring about the workers' paradise, or did you not? But it takes on much larger elements.
Interesting. It's pretty crazy, because there's been this insane overreaction, and it was worse than the election. I remember, you know, in 2016, like I talked about this in the recent interview that I did, you know, when I was undercover in Portland Antifa, and I gave an interview for Reason about that earlier this year for some of the riots. I was with them when they set a few police stations on fire. And, you know, I mentioned in there Francis Fukuyama, who has a really misunderstood. He wrote, you know, The End of History and The Last Man, and it's a very misunderstood book, because he claims in it that, you know, the world had settled on liberal democracy as the final form of government, and everything was going to be this free markets and liberty and peace and everything. And he wrote it immediately, like, he wrote it right before the Soviet Union collapsed. He wrote it right around the time East Germany, the wall was coming down, like 89. And it's people that don't understand it and have just heard about it have taken it, you know, they love to dunk on it because they're thinking that's ridiculous. The world history has not ended, but that isn't really what he meant. He did have a corollary to it where he talked about that the danger is not everyone wants that. We're not, because if you remember in the Matrix movies, they mentioned that, you know, of course it's fiction, but it was an extremely good point, that the earlier iterations of the Matrix in the film had failed because they were paradises. They were perfect. And people refused to accept that. And that's something that I think we're seeing today. We've had 30 years of Pax Americana, and we're simply not bred for peace. We're not bred to live without struggle. You know, it's people want, and this is what Fukuyama pointed out. He's like, the danger is, and this is something that this neoliberal world order that's emerging, this consensus is going to have to grapple with is that these liberal democracies do not provide the challenges and struggles that a large segment of the population needs and wants to thrive. You know, there's that thymos, the desire for glory and change. And I mentioned that, I actually quoted him in my Reason interview. I said, you know, it's like people want to struggle and everything's fine. They'll struggle against democracy. You know, they'll struggle against the best, whatever the best world you can create, they'll find a reason to fight for it. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing. Because so much of the stuff, especially this anti-racist stuff, is just crazy. And it's kind of a contradiction because you've got these people, you know, and we've seen this weird collaboration between like the hard left and this corporate neoliberal world. You've got this neoliberal world who thinks the world is perfect and they want to keep it that way and they keep wanting to move in that direction. But then you've got these people who think it's irredeemably bad. And objectively, the world we're in now is better than it's ever been in human history. In most respects, at least materially, like there's a very good argument that we have sacrificed a lot of community and other human ties that, you know, like we have seen a lot of the stuff like the opioid epidemic, especially for a big swath of America. So it's such a big thorny issue. Anyway, what do you want to jump on?
Issue here is problem that hasn't been confronted since end of World War II, and that is you can look at identity of England or Great Britain, whatever you call a great empire across the sea. They turned into a basket case post World War II. They lost colonies, they had to set them free, and since then they've never been the same. You have the troubles with IRA of them fighting to hold on to one of the last colonies, and then you have the doldrums that take place in the upper north that disenfranchise many northern English to, you know, during Margaret Thatcher, where she fires the mine workers. They've never had identity, and this continues on to Brexit. This is a long digression merely to point out that the same lack of identity, of losing new places to conquer, afflicted British spirit, and it hasn't been regained since. There's been a lassitude, as you might say. There has been a weakness. There's been a lack of identity. This itself has started to afflict America insofar as there's nothing else to do. And in fact, this is where you find the identification. What you find is, you know, after the world is conquered in World War II, you have one last frontier, that is space. But space is then declined, essentially, because there's no people to find, no people to bring to it. Instead, the war turns inwards. And that is where Great Society comes in. That is where war on racism comes in. It becomes a definition by fighting people. This never stopped. This continues on and on. That is why you see such advanced movement in Great Britain, that is in many ways past the US in some of these collaborations, and is continuing in the United States. And you see that's similar to the British stock. You see a similar trajectory.
Yeah, interesting. The space is, it's thankfully Elon Musk is working on that, because he's been working on that for a while, but that's his plan, is to go to Mars. Maybe we'll have another frontier to work on here soon. I just lost my train of thought. I was going to say something, and I just lost my train of thought on what I was going
to
say.
Do you want to pause and we come back?
Oh, yes. No, I remember. I remember what it was. I got it. Talking about, you know, struggles, there's one thing that I've continued to bring up. It's a great... one of the Star Trek original series, there's an episode called The Last Battlefield, and you may not... in case you don't recognize the name, it's the one where it's the guys, these space aliens, they have faces that are two-toned faces. One side of their face is black and the other side is white. And it's right down the middle. Maybe that'll strike memory. And the way they tell them apart is like one side has, the colors are reversed. And depending on which side of your face the color is on is whether or not you're the upper class or the lower class. And the story's about this space alien, and he's, you know, this international galactic lawman dude. He's chasing this other guy who's like a revolutionary, and they like take over the Enterprise, and they're like fighting over the Enterprise, and one of the thing, and it was a very obvious commentary on racism at the time, but I think it's got a really deeper commentary on the tyranny of small differences, because there's a part in there where they're like, why are you fighting each other? And the alien's like, can't you tell he's black on the right side of his face? I'm white on the right side of his face. You know, isn't it obvious? He's like an underman or whatever. He's like the lower class. And this people, you know, Star Trek, they're like the Enterprise crew is like, what? I don't see a difference. And that's something is like the most brutal conflicts in human history have inevitably been between people that were essentially indistinguishable to outsiders. And I think it's what we're really seeing in a lot of ways in America today is conflict like this. It's I think it's going to get worse. I think one thing too that is going to result from this is the two things that are really driving America, that, you know, the Pax Americana, that are driving our control. Because, you know, whether people like to call America an empire, and it's been an epithet for a long time. And granted, it's like we're not like a Roman empire, but we do have, you know, our power and influence is pretty dramatic. And it's two big things that drive that. It's number one, it's like the dollar standard, you know, the American dollar, everyone uses it. It's like the international standard. And the cultural hegemony we have for our cultural power. I think it's the last few days, it's very early. There's been two big pushes back on both of those. Friday, so there's this thing called the Magnitsky Act, which is a global sanction. It's a law that allows America to sanction anyone anywhere in the world. And it's actually, it has been so powerful that because of our dollar standard, and everyone had all the big banks are linked to American banks in New York, you have to follow Magnitsky rules, sanction rules, to do business in America or with American entities like our banks. So what's happened is like earlier last year, America sanctioned some Chinese nationals like Carrie Lam, who's like the leader of Hong Kong. She's like the leader of their parliament or whatever. She was sanctioned. Several other Chinese bigwigs were sanctioned. And as a result of that sanction, the Chinese banks in China had to close their accounts for these Chinese bigwigs. Like, that's how powerful Magnitsky sanctions are. It's like you are literally forcing other countries to do what you have to do. That right there is a good example of empire. Well, this past Friday, actually, I guess Saturday morning by their time, China revoked the Magnitsky Act. They passed a law, and I'll actually link it. It's going to be on my Substack that's going out later tonight. They passed a law which voids the Magnitsky Act domestically, and that's a pretty serious move. That's a pretty serious power move, and I think that really exposes a lot of where they think the balance of power is between America and, you know, China at this point. Because granted, you know, the Capitol, I think the Capitol, the storming the Capitol is a tremendous symbolic blow, because it, again, you know, like I said, we're basically one giant Roman LARP as a nation. And then when men in bear pelts storm the Senate, that's pretty symbolic in Roman history about being towards the end. You know, that is a tremendous symbolic disaster. I think as far as actual material impact, it's not even remotely close to what happened this past summer. And I actually think, you know, a lot of frustration is like, I've been telling people that, you know, it's unfortunate it happened, but I think in some sense that the Occupy Rotundo, which I like to call it, was driven by anger and frustration that was from people refusing to respond to Occupy Main Street. And that's what I call this. I've started calling this Occupy Rotunda, and I've been calling the uprising from last year, the riots, Occupy Main Street, because that's effectively what it was. The COVID lockdowns and the riots destroyed Middle America, and Middle America stormed the Capitol. So, you know, it's unfortunate for the innocent people that were killed, but, you know. But anyway, that happened. Magnitsky Act, they overruled the Magnitsky Act. And the other thing that's happening is I'm seeing the information and cultural war is they're basically starting to disconnect from America. Because here's the thing. Silicon Valley is like the heart of the internet. And I've always thought that's a terrible idea to have it there. Because you've got all these, you know, you've got all these people on top of a fault line that's going to have a 9.0 earthquake within the next 30 years, I think they said. It's terrible on national security and multiple grounds. But I have been following the internet. And like one thing I'll say is, you know, I always say a well-curated Twitter feed is a superpower. And a lot of the folks I've been following and the other areas I've been paying attention to, there's been a bunch of commentary from other national leaders that have been saying it's like this is Twitter banning Trump and Trump getting the president of the United States getting deplatformed by corporations is a serious threat. And I think it's very clear that many, many other foreign leaders and countries see that as a national security threat to them. Because it's like, wait, holy shit. You know, our economy and our information flow is in America's hands. And America's, you know, corporate and tech culture is basically going insane. So we're seeing that where I think the movement, there's a big impetus for a movement for a more decentralized internet and probably a nationalized, like localized internet for several countries. I like to describe America like is a memetic empire in the sense that, you know, a meme is something like Richard Dawkins came up with, a unit of culture. Like, you know, a meme is like a photo with words on it. That's what most people think of. But it's any type of thought or idea that people have, a concept, a piece of mental information that you pass. And America's really, you know, a memetic empire in the sense that we produce so much cultural information and knowledge and we inject it in the world. And if you go travel around the world, you'll see people wearing American brands and American clothes and using American slang that they picked up from movies. And the sense I'm getting from a lot of corners is this wokeness is a virus and it's burning through America and it's started in the information sector. And you're going to see very dramatically, very, very, like, you know, China's disconnecting financially. They're cutting off from the Magnitsky Act. They're moving towards being more independent in that direction and insulating themselves. And I think with this internet, with the tech that's happening, like we're going to see people disconnecting from the information economy as well, just to try to firewall themselves. And as this woke virus starts to spread and gets, it's already spreading, but it's, I think you're going to see a lot of that happening where people are trying to cut themselves off.
Okay, so we were having discussion off microphone because I didn't quite understand what you meant by mimetic economy. I see it more as information time economy, and that, or more, how much, where you spend your time, it's the time economy, where your brain is, what you're doing. And this is true. Much of the economy is about attention span, it's about ads watching, it's about what you're thinking, what you're doing, how you spend your time. That itself being a sort of, being an economy in and of itself. America does control this because, in fact, so many commodities have become so cheap, there is no real margin to be made on these things. You know, gas is plummeted, which is why Russia is doing worse comparatively, because commodities are cheap, and so then the one thing that isn't a commodity is time. So America does have great big hegemony here, and they are trying to, and though there has been pushback in China especially, you have homemade Chinese technology. I think this is important. You have Alibaba, is roughly equivalent to Amazon in China. You have Jack Ma, who actually talked with Elon Musk briefly. Elon Musk didn't seem very impressed with Jack Ma, but he runs Alibaba, which is, again, close to an Amazon, Alipay, which is close to a PayPal or Cash App, many things together. Jack Ma disappeared a little while back, maybe a couple weeks ago, hasn't been seen. The companies themselves were going to be listed. They haven't been listed. Question is where he's been. It would be equivalent to Jeff Bezos disappearing from America. What is going on in China? Clearly, this must be linked to the moves of the anti-Magnitsky Act China is doing. What is motivation, what is final outcome, I don't know. But this is important, and the very fact that American media is not covering this is dereliction of duty to understanding the greatest rival America has faced since at least USSR.
Interesting. Yeah, That's a good point. You know, mind share and ad clicks. I mean, so the thing about social media is, I personally view like things like Facebook and Twitter. Like there's been a push among people to. It's been a common thing where people look at them and they think they're just like a conventional web forum from like 10 or 15 years ago. And I don't think so at all. Like, I think in terms of practical effect that something like Facebook is closer to an ISP because, you know, you're putting your content on there, but more importantly, you're building your network. When you're a forum owner, you're actually building the network itself because you're bringing people to your forum. And when you're on a social media platform, you know, you're building the network. And it depends on virality. And so much of that stuff, algorithmically driven stuff, it's all ad tech information. And that's a good point. You know, it's mind share, ad click. I call it the memetic empire. That's my personal coinage because I'm a weirdo and I like to have my little names for stuff. But no, that's a great way to break it down. And I think that's the two things we're going to see in the next few years. Definitely this decade. But it's going to start accelerating very quickly. Is people are going to start disconnecting financially from America, and people are going to start disconnecting in terms of information control, at least where the infrastructure control is going to be in another country. I've been seeing a lot of talk where, I mean, China actually has it already, but what I'm actually seeing is that India is looking to be probably the place where everyone's going to start next for the second real internet. Because it's two big things. Number one, they've got like 1.3 billion people in their population. So they've got a big user base. That's the first thing. The second thing is they have such a crossover with Silicon Valley already. They have that tech capability to actually scale something up very quickly and start building the infrastructure for their local internet. So you're going to see, like, I'm already seeing folks talk about building open source phones. That's been a big thing people are doing. Because we've had this wall, like Apple and Google have like 99.9% of the phone market share in America. And so if you get kicked out of both of those, that's a huge blow to whatever your apps are. We have this, you know, it's not quite a monopoly, it's an oligopoly, but, you know, with collusion, you know, you have these people all moving in check. It's like there's economic incentives to move together, and there's ideological incentives because half of these people, or probably three quarters of these people that work at a lot of these companies, all are infected with the same mind virus. So there's going to be a big push to disconnect on all these fronts, I think.
Well, important thing to understand, again, not covered much in international affairs because everyone's worried about coronavirus, is, you know, several years back, everyone was talking about the BRICS, which were the rising nations. You have Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. That basically went away in terms of importance, and it's basically been only China. But new emerging front of nations that matter is called the Quad, and that would be the United States, Australia, India, and Japan uniting against China because they see a growing threat there. Australia, most people don't think, nearly taken over by the Japanese East Asian co-prosperity sphere, official name for the Japanese occupation of much of the South Pacific, nearly took Australia, and many Australians were very, very thankful for Americans for eliminating the existential threat of being taken over. Very isolated down there. So Australia feels very impacted because China actually just recently rejected a bunch of coal from Australia. There's been a big fight between the two. They rejected coal. They've actually been having power outages from that. So there's been a conflict between Australia and China because Australia has tremendous natural resources. China does not. And there's been conflict there. So then you have the United States allying with Australia. Japan itself, interestingly, going against China. They can go both ways. It's a very long, complex history between occupation of China, of course, and the atrocities committed versus many hundreds of years longer than that. And then finally, you have India joining into that too. And that is the most interesting one of them, of course, especially when you consider earlier this year, there was border dispute where you had Indian and Chinese soldiers who could not shoot guns at the zone. So they engaged in literal hand-to-hand combat and spiked clubs and threw each other off 1,000-foot-plus cliffs. Very interesting stuff. So this is an emerging power faction that is not covered at all. And without this podcast, it would be a fait accompli and everyone would be shocked about the new Quad Alliance.
Interesting. Yeah, I thing, you know, it's we've had 30, it's very easy to get stuck in normalcy bias because we've had 30 years of Pax Americana, this new world order that was this neoliberal world order is free trade and so many different things, and like it seems like it's coming to an end. I mean, it already is coming to an end. I think the deal is there's no fixing it. We've had a nation that's been papering over these problems for decades, but especially in the last couple of days. Like you had the Tea Party, and what happened with it, and that was this first real bubbling up of discontent, and you had grifters and establishment types swoop in and do what they usually do, which is entryism, and take it over and turn it towards establishments. And then Trump was the second coming of this, where he was the guy who the same underlying issues were there, which is there's big chunks of America that are not sharing in prosperity in the same sense that the other half of America is sharing in. The opioid epidemics, coring out all the industries and the flyover states, so to speak. There's a lot of real anger and especially with the white working class, because that's like the people no one, it's a sport to hate on the white working class. But, you know, Trump was the second coming of that. And I see that now. It's like, I hardly see anyone, especially on the left, no one is willing to really stop and ask, like, hey, let's stop trying to bury this problem and paper over it. It's let's continue just trying to suppress it, and you're not fixing the issue. Even, you know, if Trump's going to be out here soon, unless something crazy happens, Trump's going to, Biden will be in there, and like the first thing they're talking about is like they're talking about these crazy Patriot 2.0, like aimed at domestic terrorism. It's like instead of fixing the problem, they're like trying to attack the symptoms, and I don't see that going very well. I mean, the whole thing is like Adam Smith said, like there's a lot of ruin in a nation, because he meant that like, hey, a nation has a lot of things can go wrong in a nation before it actually fails, because people generally don't want their nation to come apart. It's only when like nothing works anymore and people finally hate each other enough to really start fighting that they start fighting. But and it seems like no one cares. And this is the thing, it's like America has some serious issues. It's easy to paper over them because we've got these nice shiny toys. NASA can't build spaceships anymore. It's like Elon Musk is having to build everything. You know, NASA can't even get anything off the launch pad anymore these days. Like, here's the thing, we're a maritime nation. We don't build merchant ships anymore. There's economic reasons for that. But what's really scary is we haven't successfully built a new warship design in 20 years. Like all the warship designs we have now for our Navy, like we're a maritime nation. We have the largest nation in the world. All of our successful warship designs are like 20 plus years old. You know, we've had the Littoral Combat Ship. That is a complete failure. It's been canceled. Like, we're having to buy warships from Europe now because we can't design them anymore. We can't design and build them. We're buying warships from Europe, and our carrier doesn't work. The Ford class doesn't work. We've got, you know, we've tried to build two different cruisers, and they've both been canceled or failed, or, you know, the DDG 1000 doesn't work. We've had 20 years of, you know, we've had to extend our Arleigh Burke class warships, the guided missile destroyers, because we that's the only thing that still works. We don't have anything new that works. We can't do it. That's a problem. That is like a serious degree of civilizational decline, and you see it everywhere in America when you look. It's like, and I think in a real sense, the Capitol, storming the Capitol was, you know, that was the apotheosis of the Tea Party. It's like the Tea Party came very nicely and asked and picked up their trash, and they got shit on and suppressed, and then the Tea Party came back with Trump, and in a real sense, it was like, you know, it was Tea Party 2, you know, Revenge of the Boomers or something, I don't know. What do you think?
It is encouraging to show that the right actually can occasionally learn new tricks, and that is, Tucker Carlson said it earlier this summer, the ruling class has made the decision that they don't truly understand. They've demonstrated and shown for everyone that was willing to listen, violence works. Violence works, as a great comrade Mao Zedong once said, political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Not from actually using said gun, but from the threat, from the ability, and from the ability to marshal such things. The fact is, everyone referring to insurrectionists wants to cancel American history of pissed off white people that were being taxed too much or feeling oppressed by foreign powers, rising up because their interests weren't being met and weren't being listened to. There's no venue that is going to listen to said protests. When you ask if there's a venue to be heard, there is no venue to be heard. And it is very, very interesting to ask, well, how are we supposed to resolve said differences? There is no way to effectuate political power, because political power, since at least the 1960s, has borne an element of danger, an element of threat. That is what the hard hat riots during Nixon were, where there was riots during convention, and they sent in construction workers in hard hats to beat down communists, to suppress more bourgeois communists rather than actual people, than actual comrades in the communists, which is why the proletariat successfully managed to suppress the fake communists. And so the real telling thing is, there is anathematization. There is no listening, there is no interest. This is the position of the Trump voters. They must realize is that of the kulaks. The kulaks were prosperous farmers who had more than their neighbors, not tremendous, but more than their neighbors, and they were made into the class enemies of which the Soviet Union wished to liquidate, to blame all the problems, all the starvation upon, and they bore the true brunt of Soviet viciousness. And this is what is headed for. This is what the destruction of small businesses. It's, you know, for the silly thing about the right wing is they simply lack imagination. The left already said what they wish to do. They wish to implement equity. And if you cannot build everyone up to the same level, there is another way that is much simpler, which is to reduce everyone to the same level. And that itself is very doable.
Yeah, it's interesting. Part of the identity politics, and talking about white privilege, I remember this. There was a protest in somewhere, Montana or something, I think it was, and there's a video of this white guy in a ball cap, and he was like angry and he was yelling, and he wasn't too aggressive. He was just mad. And he was just raising his voice some. But there's a Washington Post editor, Karen Atia or something. I can't pronounce it right. I think she's from Nigeria or somewhere like that. French. I think she's from Guyana. Anyway, yeah. So she is a person of color, a woman of color. And she was talking, you know, she was going off about, and she's a Washington Post editor in D.C., and she's a blue check on Twitter, and she was going off at this guy's video, this obvious working class guy in a ball cap, a white guy, who was slightly aggravated and was kind of raising his voice, and she was had this multi-long Twitter thread about this guy's white privilege and how she, you know, was oppressed. I'm like, wait a minute, it's like you're this Acela Corridor elite that is an editor at the Washington Post, and you are oppressed by some fucking plumber in Montana just because he's white, you know? And like, that's really the interesting thing, I think, what's so addictive to a lot of these folks. You start playing these status games, and it becomes a way where, you know, someone who is privileged in all these different ways can still be oppressed, because oppression is the coinage of the realm, so to speak, for these people. It is the, you know, if you're dealing with this Calvinist type of pseudo-Puritan religion, you've got your elect, and the elect are these people who are oppressed. So oppression becomes kind of your, what makes you special, I guess.
In a prosperous country where actual merit does not matter, then a relative advantage and what kind of sinecure, what you can get people to give you based off of feeling for you off of comity rather than actual ability, becomes everything. The real thing that is interesting is there is no scientific method in which to test privilege or not. There is no way to say to falsify said advantage of privilege. Does a black lawyer have more privilege than a white plumber? A black lawyer, no matter how good or bad said lawyer might be, has lawyer colleagues and has ability to speak to judges, has access to legal avenues, whether or not they choose personal corruption or not. They have access to heights, maybe not for insider trading, but to understand and to be able to threaten someone if they defame them, that they may actually be able to bring a defamation suit against them. Whereas a plumber doesn't have, can try to withhold said services, but in properly operating economy, they can't. There is always another plumber that is willing to fill the gap, as it were. And ultimately, if it comes down to food, say a farmer, the farmer could attempt to deny food, but there is no way with the mechanisms and with the overall and crushing debt which most U.S. farmers engage in, there is no ability to actually control withhold of work. And so what you see is a really interesting phenomenon, and that is that the general strike, the ability to actually threaten and withdraw labor, or to bring so much labor, to bring lawsuits to destroy people, that exists with one class of people, does not exist for another class of people. And this is the interesting thing. It doesn't matter how good a plumber you are, how much money you have. If you can't obtain lawyers, you face position of Roger Stones. You face position of many administration officials who are brought upon charges and could not get a lawyer to represent them. What do you do if there is no recourse?
Good point. Yeah, so with that, I'm going to start wrapping it up. I want to hit some suggestions for people. So let's talk about where things are going. I think this is going to intensify. I mean, these folks are not, they feel like they're close to victory and they want to try to, to finish off the enemy, because they feel that and they're going to double down. And I think things are going to get worse really quickly. I think there's going to be a lot more deplatformings. Like, they're already trying to unperson people. Children are unpersoning their parents. It's pretty crazy. Friends and family are going after cutting each other. It's everything has been turned to 11. I think we're going to see this culture war internally is going to really, really ramp up. I doubt very seriously it's going to stop anytime soon. I'm seeing a lot of people, a lot of conservatives, to finally learn the value of offline organizing and in-person organizing. And if you're interested in that, I have my season 2 episode 1, The Tribes Affinity Groups Varieties, that is a good guide to walk you through that, how to build your affinity group. So I think that's an important thing. I think this culture war stuff, this is beyond culture war. This is straight up cultural, almost genocide. This is a war to the knife. This is going to intensify. It's going to get worse this year. I don't see it dialing back any. I think, number one, listen to my episode, season 2, episode 1, about building tribes, and I think you should seriously find people in your local area, make your connections, get your tribe, find 4 or 5 people, within a local area and get together, start meeting, planning, and I'm not saying, do a militia cell. I'm just saying, get together so you have friends you can depend on. Start looking around, because we need to start building locally. Start building local communities. That's a big thing. I think we're going to see disconnections financially and information networks from not only individuals in America, but America from the rest of the world. There's going to be a big move away from the United States in both of those areas. Other countries are the risk tolerance is now, I think, the level of risk is way too high. And I think other countries are starting to realize that. Do you have any quick suggestions?
When the Romans conquered Celts, especially in Britannia, current day England, the Celts wore no armor. They wore a single torque, which is a sort of metal bracelet around their neck. And they marched out stark naked with perhaps their hair in spikes, and they considered it an act of courage to charge with no fear. Celts were brutally crushed, destroyed, and very easy because Romans wear armor. All the assault, most of the people that you saw assault capital were very brave and marched out with, you know, essentially naked themselves. They, of course, wore clothes or buffalo hat, but wore no mask. And I merely ask, do you really think that you're going to stand against surveillance state? You're going to stand against cameras? You're going to stand against many unemployed people who have nothing better to do but to ruin people's lives? You think that marching out with a mask will serve the cause? And I merely ask, would your mother say so? Would your children say so? Would the people that depend upon you say so, that you being imprisoned for this great mimetic opportunity useful? Or is it better to take upon a more underground approach? The doxing and stuff will continue. You know, in fact, when you can see the no-fly lists, you know, we still have many, many, many bills left of economic support, of shutting down more businesses. You know, with the inauguration of Biden and Harris, we have a very dark opportunity coming to shut down the country for years. And then economic benefits based off of adherence to party ideology, and class traitors and traitors to ideology receive reduced or no checks. And this is going to be a continuous thing. So I very much recommend anyone that actually considers themselves to be someone that wants to continue eating in the future and is not independently wealthy, to consider that you are not liked by the system anymore. You are considered class traitor to system, and you will be crushed every single way. And this is not the America you grow up in. Welcome to USSA.
Alrighty. Yeah, so this is Tech Bro Tito. His website, ussa.today, he's still getting set up. It's up right now. He's going to have his blog and podcast going soon. To listen in, I know this was a little bit of a longer episode. We were kind of a free-flowing episode, and we probably hit on a lot of highbrow topics. I apologize if it's a little too cerebral for a lot of folks. I try to be really accessible, but we kind of went off in some high-concept stuff. Tomorrow, I am going to have, if you enjoyed my episodes with Tad from Bolivia, Tad is going to be back on, and we're going to have a good discussion about tribe. You know, we talked about riot dynamics and some of the more theoretical stuff in the last two episodes with him. The next one that we're going to do tomorrow is going to be focused solely on, like, tribe building, like building your tribes, building your local community and your local groups for political action. The big thing is you have to have a support network, and you have to take care of yourself. You know, we were involved with a lot of the, like, I was involved with the Berkeley stuff, you know, 3 years ago, and Portland, and I know what it means when you become a meme. But we're kind of past that stage right now. It is not a good time in America's resistance to be a meme, because the meme means the eye of Sauron will be upon you. So my suggestion is focus on your safety and, you know, tune in tomorrow. Sign up for my Substack, contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I'll have that linked in the description. But tune in tomorrow for Tad. And we're going to be talking about building a local community. And if you are listening to this, you are the resistance.